Thanks a lot. Great to be here. Hope we'll also Uriol is here. We came to visit the Sergei, and he forced us to give this talk. Now I'm very happy to very happy to give this talk also in front of this audience because it's full of friends, and I think it's gonna get whatever feedback we get from it is gonna be great. And it's gonna be based on two different ideas. One of them is with this great person, Alex Jenkins, on gravitational waves on more astrophysical setups, and then with also a collection of great collaborators all on the different part of the spectrum. So I'm gonna give you some flavor of two ideas and to motivate them. Okay, let me first show you a couple of pictures of the electromagnetic signal from our galaxy in the visible band. So the visible band is great, right? We have been using it for a long time, but yeah, certainly there are some limitations to it. One of them is that dust sometimes likes to be in the way and make our galaxy opaque. So in the last century, something that happened is that we managed to basically have telescopes for a much wider frequency band, and this would bring us pictures like this one on the radio band. I don't know if the quality is good enough, but certainly you see that first you managed to look in places where before you were not able to. And also the kind of structure, the kind of physics that you are getting from it is certainly richer. Similarly, when you go to high energies in X-rays, well, again, this is the picture from Rosita, and there are even new structures, no? These very famous Fermi bubbles that appear that are even galactic size, right? So things that before moving to these new bands were not even, I think, conceived. Maybe some people have better, you know, and know this better, but from what I know, this was a big surprise, not these big Fermi bubbles in the X-rays. Now, with this in mind, we can try to think about what's going on with gravitational waves in the soundscape. Why I call it soundscape? Well, I don't know. Some people like to use this word for the frequency span of gravitational waves instead of landscape or whatever. Before that, I'm going to focus in this talk only on stochastic gravitational wave backgrounds, so no coherent sources. Maybe at the end I will comment a little bit on coherent sources, but these backgrounds are as compared to these sources that just merge and do something in a small amount of time, those are a collection of incoherent persistent gravitational waves, right? So there are many sources somewhere far away from you. All of them are doing are producing a small signal, but you on Earth, when you collect all this signal, well, what you find eventually is a kind of a stochastic signal coming from either astrophysical or cosmological origin. So there are, for instance, if you think about LISA, this kind of thing is going to happen enormously for binary stars in the galaxy, but also it may happen from cosmological phase transition. So these kind of signals are going to be there, and it's a way to look for some processes in the universe. Why I wanted to include this slide is because in searches of these backgrounds, as they are in principle very Gaussian and very stochastic, the phases are not relevant. What is relevant is really the energy density, so the energy density in the gravitational waves, and cosmologists like to put this in terms of its value as compared to the critical energy of the universe, so which, depending on your flavor, you can have it in solar masses or on kiloelectron volts, okay? And also, if you want to compare this with the amplitude in the gravitational wave, for those who are not familiar with that, the density, energy density gravitational waves is proportional to the frequency square and h square. So you can always convert this quantity into amplitude, into strain, but we are going to, for most of the time, use this. And it's also relevant that even if this is a background which is stochastic, it has a spectrum, so it carries information about its origin through this frequency dependence, right? So this is basically this observable. Okay, for those who never saw it, I guess that's right, because again, now I come to start to tell you something about what's going on in the gravitational wave soundscape. This is frequency, And this is energy density in these units. Up here, something that people not always shows is the, well, you can convert this frequency into length scale. It's going to be relevant to understand which kind of experiments are relevant for some particular frequencies. So at the kilohertz, sorry, hundreds of hertz, right, there is this LIGO-Virgo-Kagra line. This is not detection line. This is a constraint. This stochastic background has not been detected at any frequencies yet. Right? So we have seen events, but not stochastic events. This is a search. This is the bound that you get from the search. And it has to do with the kilometer size. Well, in principle, the wavelength is a bit bigger because of this is a Fabry-Perot experiment. So you manage to get things which are bigger than kilometers, but somehow the ballpark is at Earth scale wavelength. Right? On the other side of this plot, there is the CMB constraints. For a couple of months, there was a detection. No, how much was that? I don't know. But now those are only constraints. On the B modes of the CMB, I'm not going to discuss much. It's really impressive to see how deep you can go in this energy density with the CMB. And the kind of scales that you are measuring correspond to what? 10 to the 8 kiloparsecs, so really cosmological. It makes sense, right? That the CMB is traveling through this sea of gravitational waves, so you're going to be able to distinguish something which is coherent at cosmological scales, so gigaparsec or almost gigaparsec. Very, very low frequencies, right? And in the middle, well, there is this constraint here, which have to do with the fact that you have many gravitational waves in the, so you have a big energy density on gravitational waves. At some point, the energy is so high that it affects the cosmological expansion. So there is a bound always, which is flat. Why it is flat? Well, because to build it, you assume an almost flat spectrum of gravitational waves. You integrate, so you assume that there are gravitational waves, let's say, from the early universe with a certain spectrum, which is basically considered as flat. And then from this, integrating the spectrum, you can get a bound which is like this. But I'm not going to be so much discussing this bound because I'm going to be more focusing on frequency, I mean, bounds at particular frequencies. As I said, this is an integrated bound, okay? It's not really, I mean, if I find a signal here, it's not necessarily ruled out by this bound, right? Because it may be a peak going up and down. Okay. Whereas if I see it here, yeah, it should be ruled out. And then in the middle of CMB and LIGO Virgo Kagra, there is a pulsar timing arrays. And this is a kind of present from the universe. As pulsars are amazing, amazing objects. I think it's really a miracle that they exist for many things. And one of them is these guys, PTA. So the idea of PTA, pulsar timing arrays, is that if there are pulsars around you, so the typical distance to pulsars and between pulsars is kiloparsec or a bit less than kiloparsec. So if gravitational waves are in the way or in between them, then the path of propagation from the pulsar to us is going to be modified at this particular wavelength. And if there is a stochastic background, this is a stochastic process, and eventually you can kind of, with the time of arrival of the pulses, get an amazing constraint that goes also at this kind of galactic scale. So Earth scales, galactic scales, cosmological scales. Then there is this bound here, which is way worse. This is quite interesting. It comes from the fact that at this very long wavelengths, which is between galactic to cosmological, what can you do? No, you don't have this present, you don't have the CMB. So there are some people that computed in this paper that if the CMB moves through after the coupling through this background of gravitational waves, it kind of heats up a little bit. So it modifies the spectral shape. And well, those are not so amazing constraints, but maybe with future experiments, if they manage to get better constraints on the spectrum, they may start to be competitive. At very high frequency, well, then this stops here, and there's a gap. And then at some point, you start hitting laboratory size. So you are an experimentalist, and you are the best experimentalist. At some point, you are going to detect any background, right? And you may ask yourself, where are we if we want to detect gravitational waves as, you know, stochastic processes? In this case, for these high frequencies, people use the amplitude more than the energy density. And well, I don't know why. One of the reasons may be that this kind of bound and effective is so, I mean, you really believe that you are looking for a stochastic spectrum, you are so far from the bounds from an effective that it's a bit depressing. But if you have a peak here, still maybe the laboratory bounds are relevant. So that's why at high frequencies, people tend to use the strain. And at low frequencies, I think people are also interested in stochastic. Yeah, this is gigahertz, so laboratory size. Cool. So clearly there are gaps, right? Big gaps. Do they have an impact on the physics we can learn? Are they going to be covered in the future? So let me go to the future, 2040, and tell you a little bit what's going to happen. What's the landscape? Well, here, by the way, I corrected this already in the next slide, but this is, I will tell you more about. At low frequencies, CMB studies are going to keep progressing. That's cool. There's going to be a huge improvement in PTA with SKA, right? Then Gaia, you think about what Gaia does, measuring very well the position of stars. If there is a background of gravitational waves at galactic scales, people have also understood that this relative position, you have so many correlations that you may be able to cover an amazing amount of parameter space. By the way, here there is a claim detection. No, not claim detection. It's like a noise at this scale that it may be confirmed in the future, a couple of months, 3 months, okay? But I'm not going to talk about this. For the moment, there is no detection of this stochastic background. Then there is LISA. This is amazing, right? You can really start covering this gap. Then there is the future cousins of LIGO Virgo Kagra, ET in Europe, a cosmic explorer in the US, right? So there is a plan. And in between, there are what are called atomic interferometers, ION in the UK, MAGIS here, well, not here, nearby in the US. So there is a plan of what to do, but still there are gaps which are still there, right? So now the question is, why don't we do anything in between LISA and SKA? Well, this is a 2 million kilometers experiment. This is a kiloparsec scale thingy. So can you build something which is so big? Well, not really, but then you can look up these frequencies and realize that these frequencies correspond to months, days. So maybe the way to go is to look for things that can resonate at these frequencies and that are sensitive to gravitational waves. And at high frequencies, here there is a big question mark because this field is now being developed basically now. So we have no idea what's going to happen in the next 10 years, I think, well, or 20. I think it's very important for those who are not in this community to understand that there are many, many papers here. I put MAGIS, many, many papers on LISA and so many backgrounds for LISA that is amazing. How many backgrounds? Every day there are two papers on LISA backgrounds. And I think that what's going on is this kind of a carrot effect that we had also with the LHC. That because LISA is going to happen, many backgrounds peak exactly at LISA frequencies, right? And SKA is a bit the same. You can understand that if there are backgrounds that peak at SKA and there are backgrounds that peak at LISA, there will be backgrounds that peak here, right? People normally don't care about those because, yeah, there is nothing here. So you start exploring this, the physics case is quite interesting.
So you say backgrounds, you can have a strategical.
Physical and also phase transitions, for instance.
At this point, perhaps the major background would be astrophysics. I mean, LISA is sensitive to redshift z equals to 4, z equals to 6, and that's the place where they will see these massive mergers of galaxies. And they are the ones which will dominate.
The massive is, those come more or less in this band, the supermassive.
I mean, actually, nobody has computed this to a large extent, if I understand.
The supermassive background, that's something like this. The expected one is a white, I have it somewhere.
I would say, I mean, one cannot, but this is the part we don't know that.
We don't know it. Maybe we will know it in 2 months because.
I don't think you can learn it in 2 months. Also, there's a huge problem with the large megaparsec, large parsec problem. You know that.
Yeah, but there is a signal in PTA that has confirmed by all nanograph by the European PTA, but everyone. Yeah, And we are exactly exploring, I mean, the background, by the way, should be here. It cannot be here, okay? The background is here. So there's a uncertainty, and we're gonna detect this for sure. So then, SKA for sure. Yeah. Then whether you scale, no, this is maybe a phase transition from the early universe. Well, there will be an extra background, but certainly it's gonna be very hard to distinguish because you have to have the spectral shape very well measured. That's true. And that motivates the fact that you have to do a multi-band analysis. But I don't want to enter into this.
At this point, you don't yet know if it's a gravitational wave or another noise.
At this point, it's called a red noise. And rumor, well, first, it has been confirmed by all the pulsar timing collaborations, even if first was nanograph. And the rumors are, I ask people, I'm not in these collaborations, but rumors are that within 2 months, it will be confirmed as a gravitational wave background. They measure a correlation. Well, you can see it here. I'm not gonna finish my talk, right? It's fine. If this background is a gravitational wave, it has a quadrupole structure that makes sense. So you start having when you have this thingy. So you start having many pulsars. You can measure this kind of correlation in a very intelligent way, which is correlating pulsars. I have not seen what they have done is that they have gone back 30 years in their data, now that they expect the signal, and they, if you make the numbers, it makes sense that with the going back to all the data and being a bit more precise, it makes sense that they may be able to say something. So it's not that they have way more data since 1 year. It's really going back to archive data, and they claim March or April, so I don't know. Yeah, it would be the first, by the way. It would be the first. I agree. I will show the, maybe at the end, I will show the supermassive black hole expected backgrounds. Right. And also, I want to also have this kind of joke that it never works, but I do it anyway. So that we don't know what's going to happen in the future, right? So, for instance, the Terminator is based on 2029, right? So maybe we will be destroyed completely. But also, some of these lines are. To be taken with a grain of salt. For instance, the ET ones or the ion ones, they require a really huge investment in technology. LISA is more robust. Okay, LISA, I think that we can now say that it's robust, but still you have to go to space, there's everything, so yeah. Whatever you can do to add more confirmation to this kind of wavelength, I think it's gonna be welcomed by the community, okay? So let me then focus on this part of the spectrum now with a different style. This is the same PTA today. Here I added a couple of lines that were there, but they were a bit buried. This is a orbital motion of a spacecraft in the solar system, Cassini. So if there is a gravitational wave background which is stochastic, the orbit is going to be moving, and they can put some bound. And those are the Earth normal modes. So if the background is very, very strong, then it's going to heat up a bit the Earth. And they have this bound. So basically, by measuring seismographically the history of the Earth, they can also get, again, they are not spectacular, but this is what it is. I think at this today, this is the best we have. And with this in mind, again, this kind of time scales are days, months, so let's go and see if there are systems that can help us to fill this gap. And for this, I'm going to use a very simple idea. What happens if you have a binary system and a gravitational wave arrives to it? So let's go to the non-relativistic limit of the binary system. So this is the Newton law. And then you can treat the gravitational wave as an external force. And for this, you go to the center of mass of the system. This is basically the geodesic deviation equation, and it's very simple to write. So this is the external force acting on the system, right? And this is, you can find it in Misner-Wheeler-Thorne. It was revisited by Lam, Hui et al. To make it a bit more, you know, to do something similar to what I'm going to show you, but they were a bit less generic, if you want. And with Sergei and Diana Lopez, we use a similar idea to try to find for fluctuations coming from dark matter, not from gravitational waves. But the formalism is kind of similar. What do you do with this? Well, for a binary system, normally what you, and which is perturbed, what people have been doing in, well, for hundreds of years, and this through hundreds of years, they have, instead of exploring these 6 degrees of freedom here, they prefer to explore the 6 integral quantities of the orbit, the period, the eccentricity, and all the others, right? So whenever you have an orbit in space, you can characterize it by 6 initial conditions, and they can be geometrically interpreted in the, if you are clever enough. One of them is the period. Another one is the inclination with respect to us, center of reference. Also, when do you start the orbit? All this, you know, the eccentricity of the orbit, all these 6 degrees of freedom, and have this kind of a more intuitive meaning. And if the orbit is Newtonian, they are constant. If there are some perturbations, they are modified. Right? So this is, of course, has been used by people trying to understand the solar system. So the perturbation theory is very well understood. So you decompose the extra force into 3 directions, the radial, the angular one, and the perpendicular to these 2, okay? And these 3 forces change. Well, you have to treat these orbits as always basically Newtonian, but because there is this external force, these parameters kind of evolve with time, okay? The same way that when you have a perturbation given by general relativity, you can also treat it this way, and you know that there's going to be a perihelion advance or a arbitrary force. There is this formalism for which all these parameters, which are almost constant all the time, evolve with time little by little. They are called osculating orbits technique. It's called osculating because all these orbits are kissing each other basically all the time. Okay. Osculus from Latin is kissing. Yeah, in Spanish we don't have this, no? It's oscul now. Yes.
What's
eh?
Gamma?
Gamma, where is gamma?
Not
yeah, yeah. Ooh, you caught me now. I haven't checked this equation for a long time. Gamma, I don't know now. It's the Lorentz boost. Okay, well, I will check it later, okay?
Can you go back to the previous system, maybe the one before? You don't have a gamma there now.
No, no, no. I think, I'm maybe not that far away, maybe something about the, yeah, I don't know. I will tell you later. But we don't have a system with a force, we have a system with a stochastic force, right? So these gravitational waves are stochastic. So this is an equation which is like the kind of Langevin, let's say. This is going to, I mean, through this kind of equation, these variables are going to turn into stochastic variables. You can try to solve the system this way, but it is a bit more intelligent, okay, to instead, when you have a system which is has a deterministic part, the Newtonian or even GR part, plus a stochastic background, to describe it in terms of the distribution function of the variables. So there's a map to, once you know the stochastic force, build the equation of evolution of the PDF, right, of any of these variables, right? And this is given by 2 terms, okay? Right, so the idea is that this is a repetition of the previous one. Now all these variables are going to turn into stochastic variables, and they evolve through the so-called Fogel-Planck equation, whose coefficients di and dij are called, the first one drift, okay? Because what it does is that you start with a distribution. Let's say this is the period of the orbit, right? It should be a delta function at the beginning, right? Very well determined, and there will be a motion of this, which is coherent, adrift, right? And it's going to be driven by this coefficient. And then there is the diffusion, which basically makes the distribution wider, okay? And again, for each parameter, the period, the eccentricity, the inclination, all these guys, you can find an equation of this form, right? That tells you how the distribution evolves. So you are exploring the orbital By the way, this is also very close to what they do when you want to treat noise, no? Noise in these systems, stochastic noise, or asteroids, or whatever thing. This is also the language that they're going to use. It's good to put this already in this language, also for experimentalists. Right, so what happens now?
Is this PSD, spectral density curve?
This guy?
The frequency, is it in, what's the X and Y axis?
Oh, no, this is a random. This would be the distribution function for the period, for instance. That's just to show you that there are two things that happen. One of them is the drift. The other one is the diffusion. This is nothing. This is just an illustration of these two.
This one is the noise part.
The noise, yeah. These gravitational waves may have
two terms. The one which, if you go one slide before, you have two terms. So it's very nice, very interesting. So you have, so it's D2. The D2 is absolutely noise part.
Yeah.
D1 could be, because you're saying it's a determinist.
But there is also, that's interesting. There is also in the D1, which is a drift. There is, if the noise, depending on the noise, you can also generate drifts which are coherent. Okay, so noise. Noise can induce also shifts on the parameters, not only diffusion on the parameters. Okay. This was missed, by the way, by Lamb, because Lamb didn't put it this way, and this part of thing was.
You have diffusion at all. So that's what I was wondering. So if you have a single system, you can measure only the drift in a sense. Or
yeah.
I mean, the diffusion will give you some kind of error.
Yeah, yeah. Once you have the data, you can treat it this way. And you can certainly look for, and indeed, sometimes this is stronger than, at the level of constraining, the diffusion may be stronger than the drift, when you see the data.
Can be bigger than
yeah, the exactly.
Yeah, because Lamb didn't have diffusion at all.
No, they didn't go to the Fokker Planck. They just did the Langevin. It was a big surprise, to be honest.
How do you model the noise, the stochastic part?
In the data, you mean, or in this?
In your approach?
Well, let me tell you. You do a. So what we don't do is to try to measure this in each orbit. What we do is an average over orbits, right? And when you average over orbits, which because this is what's going to happen with data, no? You're going to have data for 30 years, and well, this orbital motion is faster, right? So eventually you can always average this. Over orbital motion, and what happens is that when the gravitational wave frequency is resonant with the one of the binary, so when the frequency of the gravitational wave is n times 1 over the period of the binary, then this guy contributes. So the idea, what you are seeing here is that there is a resonant absorption of gravitational waves by the binary, right? That is going to drift the motion, and it's going to also change the kind of random walk. All right? That's why we need a stochastic background in a sense, because if you want to use this for a single binary black hole, for instance, you have to be very much in resonance to be able to see it. Otherwise, you're not going to see it through this. But anyway, in a stochastic background, in principle, there's going to be, there's going to be a wide power in many frequencies, so you can use this.
Just to maybe ask you one last question. So this is about the gravitational wave, but your trajectory will also get perturbed by maybe in some nearby objects flying.
Right. Sure, sure. Let me go to this in the next slide. So
that will dominate, perhaps.
Eh?
That dominates yeah. Then gravity.
Well, again, now you go from being a theorist to being an experimentalist. Okay? Precisely. Now, where do I look for this? So I know two systems which are tracked very well. One of them is the Tyman of binary pulsars, so pulsars orbiting another star or another pulsar. And because they send us these pulses, we can very much constrain their orbital motion, right? And they are modeled through these parameters to a precision, right? You can see the data, and there is a model, and they give you a maximum error in the orbital parameter. So if you are getting more effect than what they see, then you may find a constraint. Now it's very difficult to claim detection, but at least constraining you can do. And the other one is the lunar and satellite laser ranging. So there are some reflectors in the moon since the Apollo mission, but also later on by Russian and French missions. And they are monitored once or twice per day, okay, depending on the day. And that allowed us to have a very you know, dense data set of the position of the moon in the last 40 years or so. These mirrors, well, the last ones were there, I mean, were left long ago, so they are not the best, but still they so much amount of data that the position of the moon eventually, not at this particular time, but the parameter that tells you in their modeling the period, for instance, or the distance is known to millimeter distance. Well, 10 millimeters, centimeters, something like this, right? So it's not, as I said, we are not tracking at this particular time that the moon is at centimeter distance accuracy. It's overall 30 years, the modeling is good enough. But we are putting an extra source of noise in the modeling, so we cannot go above their what they find. Right? There may be some degeneracies. This we have not done yet. So maybe all we are doing is degenerate fully with some of the parameters they use. But so far, this we don't know. With this caveat in mind, this is what we found. Okay. So this is SKA, sorry, PTA today. This is SKA. This is LISA when it happens. And with the data from existing pulsars, this is a kind of an envelope. There are many pulsars that resonate with different frequencies. You are a bit out of resonance, and also because the orbits are not exactly circular, but they are eccentric, there is a kind of width that you can, for each particular system, there is a width of frequencies that you can explore. Pulsars can bridge you a little bit. I mean, they are quite nice, but so far not so great. The future of pulsars is SKA also, and if we are lucky, the universe is generous, we can maybe get better than ineffective constraints. But what was more surprising was that the moon already, the orbit of the moon, this is much peak because we have only one system, is month period, and it can already get to amazing sensitivity. And in the future, if you go back to the moon, so we may have to convince some millionaire, but that's okay. You know? They have too much money to lose in Twitter or whatever, so come on. This is much better. So this is taking into account the future prospects for lunar radiation ranging from some white papers. They want to do it, they may not do it, who knows. Quite interesting, the satellites that already exist.
The white moon is not a single line.
Because when you look for a spectrum, when you show constraints for a stochastic background, it's not a background, it's a delta function, but you basically have a collection of backgrounds. So if I'm here, this background most likely will have a shape that, you know, is going to also be in resonance somewhere. So there is a way, yeah.
You have a model for the ground.
Exactly. So when you... That's the standard way to present stochastic background constraints. They don't refer to a delta function background, but they have a family of backgrounds that they consider physical. And within this background, within this family, if you are here,
I see.
You hit the resonance at some point. Right? Yeah.
Diego, if I may ask, so the plot you are showing is in the ideal case. You have not taken into account
this. Yeah. This is a theoretical. This is the pulsar is a bit more under control, I think, because then the noise is they are quite clean systems in principle. No. We were contacted after this was published. These people. Well, first I wrote to them. Okay, when this wasn't published, no one answered my emails. And I was writing for my CERN account. If I write from Barcelona, they may not. But then when it was published, PRL liked this article and there was a focus, and then they wrote to us. Okay, I wrote to you. But then after these conversations, they are very busy because these guys are people who have to build satellites. So they have a schedule that they eventually, it would be nice to have someone helping us with this, yeah, some students. Quite interesting, also, satellite. This is a ball. I have a picture before. This is this ball. It's a ball that whatever it is, it reflects, right, somehow. And in principle, you can build more of those. And you can put them in different orbits. This one is there already. And it allows you to do quite well in this frequency band. So in principle, you could also consider building more of these balls and covering this region. The problem is that then you are fighting LISA. So in 20 years, you're going to do quite bad, right? So whereas here, there are some ideas, but they are quite futuristic.
I ask, like, how does the asteroid noise?
Asteroids. Yeah, the asteroid is lower, the noise. Yeah, the noise for asteroids, from asteroids? Yeah. This is not, there are some papers by people in Stanford and John Hopkins, I think, that they have precisely worked this asteroid noise, and in principle, we are not there yet.
So to understand, for the envelope of pulsars, are you saying that?
Yeah. I can show you. I can show you this. This is what we do. So there are different pulsars, and they have different shapes because the eccentricity matters at some point when you have resonances. But then all of those, then we kind of build an envelope to them.
So how is this different than the official nanograph?
Yeah, the nanograph is quite different. The nanograph is the wave that is between you and the pulsar. This one, some of these pulsars, if they are in a binary system, this binary is going to expand a little bit. And there are some of those that are common. And for those, indeed, we claim that whatever PTA is doing is not totally correct. Because, yeah. So this line here, in principle, it can be drawn with isolated pulsars, because it's the light from the pulsar to you. It does in a binary, somehow.
They are using binary?
Some of them are binaries, because millisecond pulsars, which are the best to for this, they tend to be in binaries, because they have to be accelerated. Yeah.
How well do we know whether these binaries are quite isolated? Because my main worry is that there could be, not the gravitational wave, because there are other perturbations which can.
Okay, so.
Destroy, give me the fake result, that's what I'm saying.
Okay, so there is a model of the system, right? And this model has 6 parameters and some noise estimate, as usual, with all measurement.
No,
that's it.
Yeah, perhaps what they're asking, for example, like things like acceleration. But that's included.
So they. So they.
But what I'm saying is that acceleration could be due to some other.
But it's not accelerated. So they know exactly the modeling very well, and then they give me that whatever happens to the system, it has to be within error bars, right?
But that's what I'm saying is, some systematic is not in my control, because maybe I don't know some parameters which can destroy disturb the trajectory of my pulsars. That I'm worrying about the one which I don't know.
As long as you don't have a detection, then
right.
That's not if you do have a detection, then you worry about those systematics.
Yeah.
If you're just putting upper limits, then it would be weird that you have some systematic that cancels something.
I understand, but then you cannot say even gravitational waves. It could be just due to some perturbation.
Yeah.
That's all you can say.
Yeah. For example, there's some system where they see some anomalous behavior, and they see that there's a planet.
Yeah, exactly.
But I'm using systems which are very clean. They tell me, we understand this system with this modeling up to this distance. So then I can use the error bar to claim a constraint, as we do for a lot of BSM physics. Now, if we find some anomaly, no, we are not going to get a Nobel Prize, if you ask. Then the good thing about this is that if it is a particular background, so let me tell you some possible backgrounds. The one you were talking about before, supermassive black holes in center of galaxies, for instance, are supposed to have this shape. It's true that no one knows when it finishes. It finishes before LISA, because these frequencies are very, very high for supermassive black holes, right? And the detection of nanographs so far, they don't know where the spectrum so well. But with more data, maybe with the moon, we may hit it. So if we have this point and this point, then we get be more convinced. But for us, I think one of the most relevant target is super, no, it's a first order phase transitions of the early universe, where things signals like this one are quite normal. And what happens with this signal? It is exactly fitted between Nanograph and LISA, right? So if we all want to explore all these possibilities, I think that it's important that we manage to explore these ideas. And this is a realistic thing. This is a phase transition at 100 giga electron volts with the reasonable parameters. So it fits exactly here.
So can you say something more about the phase transition? What are you going to talk about?
I have a backup slide on this. So somewhere. I should have a couple of slides. This one, but that's not the one I wanted to show. Where is it? No, I lost this one. No, because I wanted to show the parameters of the phase transition. I may have erased it the last minute. Oh, no, here it is. Yeah. So, for these first order phase transitions, there is a huge community working on those simulations. But eventually, you can fit the results, right? And in terms of four parameters, more or less know what's going to happen to your gravitational wave signal. Temperature, strength, okay, order one parameter, the rate of the expansion of the bubbles. No, sorry, no, the rate of the production of the bubbles and the bubble wave velocity. All those are maybe a bit non-relativistic. This can be a bit order of a few. This is, let me not enter into this. And the temperature, which has some also, depending on the model that you put in. So with these parameters, the peak at which this happens is given by this number here. Okay. So if the transition happens for 100 GeV models, and you understand why LISA is so much emphasized, because for things that happen at tera electron volts and with order of a few parameters, you're going to hit the LISA sensitivity, which is 10 to the minus 4. But certainly, by playing with these parameters, it's also relatively easy to find microhertz peaked transitions. I don't want to say more than that. I don't know.
Yeah, but what properties? How fast properties?
Yeah. So again, I had never studied this in detail. So I take their modeling from Kai Schmitz. You know what I mean? And then I can, for instance, try to do something like this. I take these parameters, the strength, the rate, velocity, temperature, and try to see which one of these transitions are going to be detected by the different experiments. This is what we did, a very phenomenological study. So for instance, if you are talking about LISA, for instance, and this is going to cover this kind of transitions, okay, with this strength and happening at temperatures of 10 to the, well, in GeV, 10 to the 4 GeVs, right? Something like this. We're going to cover blue, for instance, with lunar radiation. So we have still an overlap with LISA, but we managed to cover lower frequencies. So this is the kind of study we did. We didn't go into the details of the transition.
Is there any, I'm sure people have done it, I have not been following. So, because in general, it's very hard to get a first order phase transition.
In the standard model. Beyond the standard model, is very easy. Yeah.
No, but it's not easy to get it. Yeah,
that's what
it's not easy to get it so strong. I agree.
That's okay. So the question is, hidden
Yeah.
I take your criticism that in principle, the kind of phase transition that we are going to explore are more tuned than those that LISA. LISA has a wider goal, and for us, yeah, this kind of signal could be fine tuned in a sense. If they can exist,
I have no idea. That's why I'm asking.
Yeah.
I never worked on the topic. All I just know, whenever the plug is a number, all I've seen is talks where they assume that it's very stronger. There is always a hierarchy between two scalars, and you have.
Yeah.
So that's.
I take your criticism.
I just don't know if there is any how you can get. I just don't know.
Our approach to this was the people who are doing this for a living, they produce some white papers, so we go there. Oh, these guys, there are people like Daniel Figueroa or Kai Schmitz. I think these people are doing this for a living.
They are driven by the fact that they want to get this transition. But the question, one real question should be that, is there a particle physics model?
No, there is, that's for sure.
Under which I can really get...
No, this is, the answer to this is yes.
The answer is large N. Models tend to give you easy life.
So large N is what?
I mean, large N. So you embed the standard model into a large N. The second and holographic model tend to be first order. I understand, but I think this extends to the judge.
Yeah, but then the question is, given that we haven't seen anything at the LHC, right? 100 GeV is the energy that's probed at the LHC.
Yeah.
How big is the hierarchy between the whatever that and the standard model? I mean,
I cannot answer this. Yeah, but again, to us. What we try to do is to really select out of the literature with which backgrounds would be fitting in this microhertz.
To ask this question, because sometimes we are motivated by the success, but we should see what kind of models really.
Yeah, you can forget about this if you want. If you want to only care about standard model signals, we may see the supermassive black holes from binaries in galaxies, and that's it.
How do they scale? PTA, you said, maybe seen evidence of this one.
This is realistic. This is the spectrum that you expect. And at some point it cuts, but this final parsec, as he was saying, you don't really know. You expect them to reach more or less these frequencies, right? But they don't really know. It's very hard astrophysically.
What has to be done to get the lunar one down as low as that? You said there's a billionaire gives you money, you do it, but what do they do? Would it better be here?
Sorry?
How did they improve the lunar signal?
This one?
The blue one. But how
do
you said that
this?
The blue arrow. There, that.
Yeah. What has to be done?
They have to go back to the moon.
To
replace the mirrors. These mirrors are technology from the 70s, and now they can do much better. Yeah, and they have their plan to do it. Now, it's going to happen.
I think then the Chinese go back to the moon.
Yeah, but they have to agree with the rest of the community to replace the mirrors. So I don't know. Excuse me?
I think they've been talking about it for a while.
Yeah.
I mean, that mirror is from the first mission. They put this square thing, and they did all this stuff, and it wasn't perfect in any way. I think they've been planning to do that for a while.
Yeah. It could be a nice enterprise. And now they're going to... Europe is going to go to the moon again.
Everyone wants to go to the moon.
But there is also a problem of the far side of the moon.
But then you cannot do it, because you have to reflect it. Yeah, well, that's a different story.
So, but then they're doing it for the year with
the new. Then, well, not really, because then you can measure much faster. The cadence with the new mirrors, this is really 2040. If they go in 10 years, we accumulate all this data. Yeah, but that's the best thing. That's the most important thing. New mirrors allow you to track much better. Yeah.
With the same
lasers. In principle, they don't talk about changing the lasers, but yeah.
This is easier to change, right?
All right. Okay, so... But the summary is that this binary resonance seem to probe this unique in the sense that this gap. We developed this Fokker-Planck treatment, which allows you to directly go into, experiments. Yeah, there are unique constraints in the sense that so far we can get better than anywhere else there. There are some proposals, by the way, in this band, but they are even more futuristic. And also, as is clear from the questions, the thing to do now is to run this on real data. It's hard for a theorist to put yourself into this program. But again, I think it's totally worth it. Okay.
Yeah, so can you tell, so you said sometimes the diffusion is more important. So what kind of physics, what's the intuition behind, in which case it's more important?
It is because the diffusion are proportional to the period to a higher power, I think. So if the system is very low, very slow, the parameters may be this. I don't know intuitively how to... You observe something that... I don't know. Maybe because the drift is very small. The drift, for instance, when I show you, the drift depends. This is the force, and the drift depends on the derivative of the force, and the diffusion only on the force. So, derivative with respect to the parameter. This is derivative with respect to the parameter.
We have also the I. I mean, the first part in the drift is.
Yeah. But this, in principle, you know what it is. This is the deterministic part.
From the force, or it's not?
No, this is the post-Newtonian or whatever. This is the model.
I see.
Yeah. So here is the, you know, eventually the parameters are not the same for these two coefficients. So I have 5 minutes?
So this is very interesting. I really enjoy.
Okay, thank you.
What happens in the Hulse and Taylor pulsar? I mean, because.
To what? Hulse Taylor? You want to see Hulse Taylor?
What is the frequency for the Hulse and Taylor? I mean, and that has been very well studied.
Yeah, no, this is not.
So can you put something, some constraints from?
Okay, where is Hulse Taylor? Is this orange? Orange, okay, this one.
Sorry, this one.
The best is the slowest possible pulsars. And by the way, people are not measuring them very well because they were kind of useless for testing gravity or for these kind of things. Because there's guys, as for this kind of effects, as for ultralight dark matter, those are the best ones. So there is also from our point of view, it would be great to motivate these guys doing pulsar observations to measure better the slow pulsars that normally are like, you know, poor people and poor guys. No one cares.
Like marginalized over like the local secular.
Sorry.
Courses. Are these individual curves for these individual pulsars?
Yeah, we take the data from the pulsar, and there is an error bar accumulated along a number of years with a certain cadence of data, and with this we can more or less.
Yeah, right. So my question is, are these like somehow marginalized over the unknown local forces coming from, you know, like local tidal fields?
Yeah, that could be the thing we have not done yet. In principle, they have done it when they present the error bars. You see, they tell us the period cannot grow more than,
so or the okay, is the assumption here that these are all just purely Keplerian, there's nothing else affecting?
No. The model of the orbit is more than this. The model of the orbit includes many things in the V part, let's say.
This doesn't overcome the model.
Yeah, so the model they have is closer to, they have a model which looks like this exactly, where here, instead of gravitational waves, they have post-Newtonian effects, the acceleration from the galaxy, the whatever. If there is a planet, all this comes into their modeling, and we have an extra piece on this.
Okay, so they do marginalize over.
They do. Yeah. For them, they do. They understand all the systematics.
How do you have any constraint on the gravitational waves once you marginalize over like unknown third companions?
Sure. That's what I was saying. That in principle, you can say we are not going to be degenerate with them. So. No, I don't know. I mean, in principle, they say that there is nothing in the model that can make their period grow more. Okay, let's take the moon, right? They claim that the parameter that characterizes in their modeling the distance to the moon has not grown in 30 years more than 1 millimeter. That's their statement. I'm telling you that if the gravitational wave background is bigger than what I show here, this parameter had, in principle, we have grown more than 1 millimeter. So that's the kind of a statement I can make. But it's true that I have not done a full Fisher matrix or whatever. There may be some hidden assumption that.
So I guess maybe the frequency is the main thing. So you're assuming that there is nothing in your problem which has the same frequency as, I mean, the signal you're going after. So I guess they assume they're slow or something, but.
No, they have certainly a lot of noise in their model, but they kind of subtract. They know how to treat it at the level that when they give you the model of the motion, there is one parameter, which is the period. And they tell you, we know this parameter, measured in this way for 30 years, to this level. And what I'm telling you is that if there has been this stochastic heating of the system for 30 years, there should have been an extra circular effect making it grow for one.
Well,
I'm saying that there is a systematic part that they have not in their analysis, and they should see it, no? They should see some systematic drift.
No, there is one subtlety here because some systematic effects that they do take into account are actually bigger probably than that.
Yeah.
With period, the Shkolsky thing. So.
I know.
Right. But so in the sense they
they know the acceleration
some of the systems.
The large scale tidal field.
For instance, yeah.
They know with some good precision. Okay. And that's a subtraction. For example, like when you take bounds from just period, right? So there's a fusion. You don't just from the acceleration, right? The bigger one.
Yeah, but on top of that, there can be like unknown third companions.
Yeah,
changing.
But they don't see it in their modeling.
That's good. But then, besides what you're saying, that of course, model like accidental cancellation is to do different attacks. Okay, if you don't assume that there are accidental cancellations.
But that was my question. Yeah.
Yeah. As I said, for now we assume that there is no this kind of. Now we have to do then with the data. The full model, which is all their systematics, our new model, our new effect, and run it and see what happens.
Is there some way, to use that the gravitational waves?
It's quadrupolar.
Will be like the same.
You can do this. You can do this.
Yeah.
You can do two-point correlations. Yeah. If you have many satellites, you can also explore these kind of things. Yeah, this kind of thing.
Okay, but so far none of that's been.
No. We published this last year, and so far we, as I said, we are in contact with this kind of people, but we.
And what happened with the solar system? People have been monitoring the.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
There is no way. No. We didn't. You can use Cassini. The Cassini. What I showed with the Cassini is somehow going in this direction. That's the best. Cassini is an orbital motion, which is very well understood. And this is what you get. So this is the order of magnitude, which is certainly, we are here at different frequencies. Okay, so I don't have time for the rest, I think. But just to, let me give you the flavor. It is more interesting for some people here, but what the other gap that I wanted to discuss, so can I have 5 minutes? Or?
Yeah.
5 minutes. So it's what happens at high frequencies. And here the panorama is even worse. You want to be very critical with sources. Here, the panorama is worse because at high frequencies there is nothing clearly there. Okay, for instance, you can divide the different backgrounds into stochastic, ones we are exploring, standard model and new physics, and coherent, so a source that boom, and then in this kind of map you can try to fit it with the models. It's a stochastic background at high frequencies, so when inflation happened or when the universe thermalized, there is this thermal fluctuation that have an associated gravitational wave emission. Okay, this has been computed, but this is tiny. I will show it in a second. Inflation will happen also. It is between standard and non-standard, depends on you. But again, you will generate this, but again, this is very small. And beyond the standard model, phase transition, all these things can happen. But again, as I'm going to show, all these are very small. It would be great to have something which is happening nearby, exploding and generating these gravitational waves. But those gravitational waves, they correspond to kilohertz or higher frequencies. And you need something very big to coherently produce them. And this, just by causality, you cannot have a star, vibrating at more than 10 kilohertz, it will basically dissolve. So there is no big things that happening here. You can have new physics here. So you can have light primordial black holes, ultralight dark matter fields. For instance, in this boson clouds around black holes in super radiant pictures, when the black hole rotates, you can go to high frequencies, but the reason why people were not so excited about these high frequencies, I think, was that it was hard to motivate new sources. And here I'm going to be more specific. So for instance, this, as I said, is in amplitude and in frequency. And this is the kind of gravitational waves background that you expect from a cosmological model that makes sense. All right? And those are the kind of bounds that we can reach from laboratory searches so far. So there is a huge gap here, right? How to fill it? Well, there has been some activity on maybe primordial black holes merging nearby. And the kind of backgrounds that has been achieved by modeling this relatively better tells you that, yeah, these backgrounds will be there. For instance, this is the background that you expect from 10 to the minus 6 solar masses primordial black holes. Okay. What's the problem with this? Is that these guys merge very fast. And when you see this, when you see this, these bounds, typically they have an integration time of more than 1 year. So this is one of the most confusing plots in the papers in the history, because this is not true. I mean, this, you see, this signal is there, but it lasts a millisecond. So you cannot use a cavity for 1 year to detect it. Yeah, you can, but then your constraint is going to be, I don't know, maybe here.
But also, how close does it have
to be? Sorry?
Doesn't it have to be like next door?
No. In this case, they give you the yeah, I have not here. I think is there in these models, you expect one of these per year. So that's the way they fix the models. I think in the within the realistic distance, they said that you would have one. Yeah, let me see.
What is the logic of these guys?
Maybe 1 kiloparsec. It wasn't, well, it's close enough. But you expect one of these guys hitting the Earth at this amplitude per year. You know what I mean? Doesn't matter. Yeah, they basically have to. Yeah, they have a model.
There is no, I mean, if it lasts for so short, this is an impulse search. It's
not I agree. So this plot is completely confusing. So I think this is more relevant. Okay, I have not, for instance, I'm not going to explain it, but we have been using cavities to try to look for these guys, and I think this is us. But yeah, we have an integrating time of 1 year. Why? Well, because we want to show what can happen for other events that are there for one year. But if we want to explore these kind of events, we are not going to reach them.
There are searches for like coherent wave sources?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But again, just the idea that we follow is the following. So it's trying to use something which is already there, cavities looking for axions, to detect gravitational waves. How this can happen? You take Einstein-Hilbert action. You see that this is quadratic in the electromagnetic field, and it's going to be coupled to the gravitational field somehow. No? You have to take the indexes up, whatever, square root of g. So when you expand this, you can see that if you have a background field, right? Let's say that you have a background field F, then there's going to be a coupling to electromagnetic fields, which is going to be F and then gravity, no? So there's a coupling gravitational, sorry, electromagnetic field and a current produced by the gravitational wave and the background. So when a gravitational wave arrives, if there is a background, it will transform into a photon sometimes, right? And this is exactly what people have been running with axions. Well, not all the searches, but the axion couplings, one of them is of this form, axion, electromagnetic field. So the idea is that whenever you have been looking for how big is this coupling, you can now to use it by how big is this wave, right? Because in the case of axions, in principle, you know the amplitude, you know the coupling. In the case of gravity, you know the coupling. Unfortunately, it's very small. But you don't know this amplitude. So the idea is that you can transform the bounds on this into the bounds on this. And what this turns out to be is what I showed, well, these people were showing before. So that in principle for gigahertz, this is now amplitude and different experiments for, well, this is ADMX-like experiments or something that is already built, 10 to the minus 21 for around gigahertz. Maybe in the future, 10 to the minus 22, 10 to the minus 23, but it's still very far away from real sources. Shall we? This is 1 year of integration, as I said. So shall we give coherent source? Yeah, something that is really kicking you.
Aliens.
Yeah, aliens or super radiant clouds, by the way. This, who knows?
Primordial black holes.
This is primordial black holes. I like to show this guy. This guy is Amundsen, okay? So
We are cannot go into the South Pole. But now, are we Scott or Amundsen? Eh? This is the question. Did we plan well the expedition? Did we bring horses or did we bring dogs? It's not clear to me. All right, so.
This calculation for stochastic.
For stochastic, is not so promising. It's worse. Yeah, yeah. And I'm gonna finish with this because I'm already boring you. Still, this I think this field to me is well, is worth exploring because we so far we are recycling ideas, but. Well, in a place like this one, like you know, where you have contact with quantum people and whatever, or well, you have here experts on this kind of searches for dark matter with a quantum system, in this kind of dialogue may eventually produce some breakthrough.
Just because you mentioned heterodyne, so is the homodyne experiment? Or?
Yeah, it's an homodyne. Yeah. So this is my conclusion. So there is this kind of soundscape with gaps. These gaps have more or less physics in the sense that some signals may be hidden there. And also, it's interesting to do complementary observations precisely because these stochastic backgrounds are very hard to, you know, to pin down. So the better, the most points in this you have, the better. And well, I presented this microhertz with some detail and the gigahertz with no detail. But well, you can find more information in the publication. So thank you very much. And yeah. Yeah, sorry. So,
homodyne or heterodyne? Because heterodyne are looking into the side bends.
We have both searches going on.
I mean, another question is more of a control of the system, how well you can control the system.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't have time to discuss. In principle, the most of what I showed here is an homodyne search. We are now finishing the heterodyne and allows us to go not to gigahertz, but to basically from hundreds of kilohertz to gigahertz. Because you can to explore the precisely not exactly the resonance frequency, but other frequencies.
But that could be your own systematic error in the system, in your experiment also.
Yeah, yeah. The noise and the systematics are totally different in both setups, I agree.
Have some noise budget for your experiment.
Yeah, but I will show you later because I have to start from this would be 10 minutes at least.
Yeah, sorry. So what sets the gigahertz scale here? Like what would it take from
the stupid,
like a petahertz?
Okay, this is the thing that I'm also going back to your question. The way this works, there are two possibilities. There is a box, mm-hmm. and this box has conducting walls. So in the middle, there's going to be a set of modes that are going to live there, right? And these modes are, which is the typical wavelength, is going to be given by the size of the box. These are cavities which are centimeter size. And this automatically gives you gigahertz. So if you have a magnetic field which is going through the box, now if the gravitational wave arrives, and it is a gigahertz frequency, you may convert into a gigahertz frequency guy, and then you start accumulating there. You can only accumulate waves which are of the size of the cavity. Yeah. And that's what fixes it. Yeah.
But the question is how well do you have to protect this system?
How well?
Well, I have to protect the system.
Okay, then you go and ask the people doing axiom physics, and they tell you, we have been doing this for 30 years. And they
and that's what I'm saying. They have
yeah, yeah.
To, I mean, is there any paper? I'm just asking. Paper which does all the
of course.
Systematic and noise.
Of course. Okay. Yeah. I mean, ADMX is one of the examples, but I don't know how many cavities there are. RADES, I don't know. I have them here, right? So we use some cavities. I mean, all these people are expert cavity people, and they tell you, well, they have been, again, this at least since the 80s, no? Sikibi was the guy who proposed it, no? And they have not seen any signal. Now, you can ask. If they see a signal, it's going to be a gravitational wave, yeah. or it's going to be an axion. In this case, we are more lucky because the way this gravitational wave couples, I have a stupid drawing. Here it is. When a gravitational wave arrives, and there is a magnetic field in this direction,
it's going to kind of excite things transversal to the wave. So the kind of modes that it excites are different. The kind of current it generates is kind of like this, and with a kind of quadrupolar, whereas the scalar one, the axion when it arrives, the direction that it picks the current is the direction of the magnetic field. You can even do an antenna with this. You can even, with two of these guys, you can know where the, because the, this is something you can measure. You can see where the wave comes from. Yes?
Going the other way, like how big would it be feasible to make these cavities?
How big?
How big, like you wanted it to go to lower frequencies?
Ah, with a single cavity?
Or
there are cavities. There is a big cavity in Italy which can reach, I think, 10 megahertz, and you can put a car inside. It's really, yeah. But the other way to search for these waves is coming to this heterodyne. It's the second one. So the idea here is you have a cavity, and you load it with a mode. Okay, there's a mode here with a frequency, and now. The gravitational wave arrives with a certain frequency. It couples to this one, and then it generates a different wave that is going to have a frequency which is the original one plus or minus the one of the gravitational wave. Okay, so this is the it should be the other way around. Omega one plus or minus omega gravitational wave, and that means that if these two has frequency which is very near each other. Not gigahertz, it can be megahertz, for instance. So you have to do a system where you have two normal modes which are very close to each other. Then you can excite the second one with a lower frequency. So you don't need to do a big cavity, but it's better to do this kind of heterodyne search. By the way, something funny is that the Earth has this also. It's called Schumann resonances. The magnetosphere has also natural resonances in it. So. You can try to see if this works. We have not managed, but yeah. All right, I think I don't want to abuse more, so thank you very much.